Christopher Clark. I'm a historian, a professor of history at the University of Connecticut, and I am the head of the history department at UConn at present. I'm also a member of the university senate, and in fact at the moment moderator of the senate. My interest in this is as a faculty member. Clearly, it is of great concern that students should have access to the educational resources we provide for them, and that includes being able to afford the materials that will enable them to advance. I hope to be able to learn a lot from being on this panel and to be able to communicate with my faculty colleagues at UConn about ways in which they can make materials accessible to students. Thank you.
Good morning. My name is Susan Dean, and I'm faculty at Charter Oak State College for many years. And I have to say, over the last several years, how many emails I get from students that say, do I really need the textbook? And my full-time job, that's not my full-time job. My full-time job is that I'm an associate professor of nursing in an online program for SUNY. And I'm one of the SUNY fellows for Open SUNY and Open SUNY Commons, and have been working with OREs through SUNY for about a year. Mm-hmm. So I'm hoping that I can maybe help and bring some resources of how SUNY kind of does it and help the committee in that way. Thank you.
I'm Jim Brunt. I'm an associate professor of English at Gateway. I'm here also in, as a member of the faculty, and I hope to learn and become more informed and find things that I can bring back to my peers. I do have a lot of concerns about this, considering that the students at Gateway are some of our most needy learners in the system, and very often they simply can't afford textbooks. So I'm hoping to learn and advise here and make their lives a little bit easier in school.
Good morning. My name is Dan Barrett, and I'm a professor of psychology at Western Connecticut State, and also the president of our university senate. And it's great for me to be here. It's nice to see a good mix of admin, library-related people, and also faculty. It's good, and a student. Hopefully we have more than one student later on. Anyway, so my interest in this is that it's twofold. One is that, of course, we want students to have available, affordable, and credible resources for the classes. And secondly, we want faculty to be able to have freedom in what we choose to use in our courses. Without that, then it really would undermine the integrity of our teaching and of our universities and colleges. I'm also a textbook author, and for many, many years, I actually refused to use textbooks for several reasons. I have a philosophical opposition to certain kinds of textbooks that have been written, and secondly, it was a cost issue. So I wrote a textbook with Sage Press in part because I wanted to have a lower cost book available to students. It's a soft cover and so on and so forth. And I can say more about that later on. But I didn't use a textbook because I wrote it. But otherwise, typically haven't liked most textbooks out there for a variety of reasons. Thank you.
And last but not least, I'm Chris Kirker-Stewart. I've emailed all of you. I work at the Office of Higher Education. I'm here as Jane Charleglio's appointee. We are the Consumer Protection and Approval Agency for Independent Post-Secondary Education in Connecticut. And so we're looking at this from that perspective.
And just by way of introduction, because I just kind of launched into this at the beginning, my name is Greg Haddad. I represent the 54th House District in the Connecticut General Assembly, the House. My district includes the University of Connecticut and its 13,000 undergraduate students, which make up, I think, 55% of the total number of all my constituents. I think both as a state representative who is very concerned with the high cost of higher education and where it's headed, I'm a member of the Higher Education Committee. We've been struggling, I think, to sort of figure out ways that we can ensure that a college education remains affordable for low and middle income families. So when I was invited to the university, I think a year and a half ago or so, to go to a forum that was sponsored by the Connecticut Public Interest Research Group on open source textbooks, sort of, it was very clear there's a sort of a light bulb went on over my head and said, wow, here's something that looks like it's actually achievable, that can provide significant relief to students in terms of the cost of their textbooks. And that can, I think, if you extrapolate that out over the number of students and the number of textbooks, and you know, if we can just get every student to have one open source textbook in place of one of their most expensive commercially available textbooks, then I think that that provides really like thousands of dollars of savings over the course of their career. And so so last year the Higher Education Committee had a public hearing on this. It was quite illuminating, actually, and we certainly heard from lots of students who came to testify that textbooks were indeed a real burden. We heard from students who were making choices about which courses to take based on how much the textbooks cost, and they were trying to avoid very high cost out-of-pocket expenses by making their course selections. We heard from students who were enrolled in courses but were borrowing textbooks from other students rather than purchasing themselves. And we heard from students that were, sort of muddling through courses without not just buying the textbook, but without really having a reliable way of viewing the textbook that had been assigned to the course. And so it seems to me like if we're going to be asking students to pay what they do to attend our colleges and universities, that we have an obligation to make sure that we try to make them as affordable, those options as affordable as possible, and that we're not, that their education is not undermined really by the cost of a very expensive textbook that they can't afford and try to get by without. So we passed this legislation last year. Actually, let me just say, we're going to review the mission as it's stated in the legislation that passed last year. We have to select from the task force members ourselves the co-chairs, and then we'll have a sort of a generative conversation about what this task force should do to meet its mission, and how we might be able to structure our meetings in the future. I will say, at this point that I am not a member of your task force. I'm going to make my remarks and sort of steer this group through selection of the chairs, and then we'll happily sort of step away, be available to you as a resource, but really enable you to sort of make the best decisions possible based on what's going on the ground and colleges and universities in Connecticut, and then those recommendations can come back to us. I'm not an expert by any means in this. That's kind of, I think, what a legislator means, is not an expert in anything, but hopefully a good listener. And so this will give you, my hope is that this task force will give you an opportunity to sort of speak clearly about the need for progress on open source textbooks and to develop a plan to work collaboratively so that both publics and privates, I think, might be able to benefit, both public and private students might be able to benefit from whatever structure might emerge from this task force. The bill that passed last year, Special Act 15-18, I think you all have a copy of it. There's some definitions in Section 1. Section 2, also in Section 1, what we did is we required required both the Board of Regents and the University of Connecticut to establish a pilot program for the use of open source textbooks. That was easy lift, I think, because there was so much interest already within the University of Connecticut system and also the Board of Regents system. And we knew that there were things that going in, but this sets up a reporting process so what you learn on the ground through your pilots can come back to the General Assembly for our edification. Section 2 establishes the task force, and it says the specific task is to consider the development of a program to incentivize the creation or adaptation of open educational resources that will significantly reduce the cost to students of course materials, including but not limited to offering financial or academic or professional credit to faculty to create open educational resources. And then the task force members are enumerated. Here, the task force is required to report back to the General Assembly no later than October 1st, 2016, which gives us gives you a substantial amount of time, I think, this year to sort of both look at what's happening in the pilots that are running in the Board of Regents and at UConn, and also to sort of develop a program that might address this final task. I don't know if anybody had any sort of questions or comments regarding the sort of mission of the task force. Seeing none? Great. The action we need to take at this meeting, aside from moving on to the generative conversation, is the selection of task force co-chairs. The legislation requires that one of those co-chairs be from an institution that's represented from makes up the composition of the Board of Regents, and one from the University of Connecticut. If I'm going to be heavy-handed anywhere, it's going to be here, I guess, because I'm going to offer a nomination. Additional nominations can be made from the floor if they'd like. But I've been, having been involved in this, passage of the legislation, was very impressed with the work that Kevin Corcoran had already accomplished at the Board of Regents as Executive Director of the Connecticut Distance Learning Consortium, and also that Martha, as chair of the group out at UConn, had done. I think that they, for me, are the obvious choices, and so I'd encourage their election. But if there are other folks who might be interested in serving in that role, of course, now would be the time for you to sort of express that interest.
I don't know either of you very well, or actually at all. I would like to see a faculty member that will be a co-chair. These are both folks who are administrative people, but having faculty as co-chair would also be very important, I think. And I'm not sure if there are any faculty members here who want to be co-chair, but I think it's worthwhile to at least consider having a non-administrative person be personally in charge of the task force.
Is there any further discussion? Does anybody want to, should members of the task force make those nominations? Now, I'll just open. I'm not a member of your task force, and so I don't think I can actually formally nominate folks, but if you'd like to make a nomination, and then we'll move forward. And anybody who's interested can make a nomination at this point.
I nominate Martha Bedard, as she is leading the UConn initiative on this.
This motion's been made, and
seconded.
Made and seconded. Martha. Maybe we'll proceed by having election the first co-chair and then the second co-chair. I don't know how else to conduct an election. And so are there any other nominations, I guess, for the first co-chair? Seeing none, I'll ask again if there are any nominations. Any nominations? Third? I guess not. Then I'll declare nominations closed, and we'll cast one vote in favor or against electing Martha Bedard as the co-chair of the task force, as one of the co-chairs of the task force. All those in favor, please say aye.
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 Any opposed? Okay. Congratulations, Martha. Do you want to conduct the election for the second co-chair since you've already been elected a co-chair?
I would be happy to. So are there any nominations for the second co-chair, which is to be representative of the Board of Regents?
I'd like to nominate Kevin Corcoran.
I'll second that.
Are there any other nominations? Is there a second?
Okay, I'll second myself.
Okay, so I guess we have to, should the entire committee, vote? So all those in favor of Kevin Corcoran, please indicate by saying aye. Kevin, are you voting for yourself? Okay, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7.
I think we know the outcome.
It appears as though Kevin has been elected, but we thank Daniel for his willingness to serve, and we'll certainly assured that the faculty have a voice.
Thank you.
Since co-chairs have been elected, I guess I'm going to start allowing them to serve. Run these meetings. I think what we put on the agenda next was a generative conversation about the work of this task force. And out of that, I think that, you know, hopefully that, you know, we'll see what work can be done over future task force meetings in terms of scheduling agendas and having folks come in and make presentations to sort of structure the rest of the work of the task force. And so with that, I'll turn over to Martha and Kevin to lead that conversation.
Well, I think one of the things that we might want to take up early on is to get sort of a baseline of where we are in our both of our institutions. Right now, Ron is going through the Institutional Review Board to come up with a survey tool that we'll send to faculty so that before we begin to get more sort of with some of our initiatives with faculty, we know where they are. We can assess at the end. Kevin, I think you've been involved in this. Perhaps you could address whether you think this is a role we should take or a place to start?
Absolutely. We at the consortium have tried to do some data collection, not only across the border regions, but not only across the state with the independents, but across the region as well. The challenge we've had is that it's hard to get to the right people to actually do the data collection, and then there's some reservation on actually sharing that data for whatever perceived purpose that the data is going to be used. So I think one of the roles that we all can play is help reach out to our colleagues, our leadership, in any form or fashion, and help recruit folks. What I've found is many folks don't even know that they're working within an OER setting. They've adopted something, but they don't know that it's been officially labeled as that, and maybe they may not be doing data collection. So I would like to offer for review at some point in time is that the Northeast OER Consortium did put their heads together on a format for data collection. So there is an Excel spreadsheet that has been somewhat vetted throughout the region that I can send to this group, and we can look at it, and we can rip it apart as we see fit and enhance it for data collection.
Great. And I'll send forward to the group the tool that's been developed at UConn, and we can rip it apart too. And I think it might be, since we haven't yet begin to administer, it might be in our best interest to try to come up with a common tool. So I guess that's our first action item is Kevin and I will share survey tools, and then we'll discuss the right questions and how to disseminate the tool to get a baseline so that we can understand where our faculties are, where our institutions are at this point in time.
I do want to address what Daniel and James brought up as far as the representation of faculty and maybe raise the question of that we have all been appointed by some legislative designee, but we by no means are the collective knowledge base for all of the state's efforts. And we do have experts that are not at this table today, and there are regional experts as well who represent organizations like SPARC. And what is the task force view on inviting folks to either be participants, not necessarily members of the task force, or expanding the task force so that maybe there is more faculty representation? Especially for the Board of Regents' sake, there are two what I would call innovative faculty out of Housatonic Community College that I've talked at length at nauseam about the success they've had, and I would love to see them involved in this conversation in some form or fashion, whether officially or not.
Could they take the form of presenters to the group, testifying and
I agree that it's really crucial to get the faculty right centrally involved in this, because it's not going to succeed if the faculty don't embrace it. And one of the things we're doing at Eastern, because we're not nearly as far along as you are at UConn, is just asking the faculty what they're doing. And bringing together a group over a faculty development lunch to discuss the people that are actually using OER in some form with other faculty that may not be using OER, just to share what the possibilities are. And I think one of the things that this group could do, among other things, is to try to identify and organize what is already out there that's
right.
good. Because the Pew Foundation, I believe it was the
yeah.
Pew Foundation report, said that one of the biggest obstacles to faculty using OER is not that they're unwilling, but it takes time and effort to identify the good textbooks or whatever else is available as open access, and they're busy. They, you know, at the in the Board of Regents, they're teaching four loads. It's hard to take time away and try to analyze all of that. So, you know, if we could make an effort to try to organize all the good materials that are already out there, that would probably be a step too. And I know a lot of that's already been done.
So that could be one of the outcomes, a deliverable from this group is a way to have organized and vetted the authoritative materials and perhaps put them up on a website or refer to other websites that have them.
And our faculty
yep.
could help us to do that.
Right.
I mean, they're the ones that are the experts in the various disciplines.
Chris?
And to add to that, it occurs to me that a significant proportion of teaching that is done by adjunct faculty who are not paid for preparation time and for whom ready and rapid access to materials or rapid decision-making about what materials to use will be a priority. And I think we probably as a body should pay close attention to the needs not just of permanent faculty, but of adjuncts as well, because they're such an important part of our system.
James?
I'd like to say, too, that we should compare and contrast some open source materials to some materials that are that we have to pay publishers for. Just speaking as someone who led Gateway's English developmental English response to PA 1240, we looked at some open source materials and found them not nearly as good as the program we went with, which had an algorithm which tailored the computer program to the student's specific needs. And I think we would be missing something if we didn't have some kind of comparison and contrast to how sometimes these paid materials do offer a chance for better outcomes.
One of the outcomes of the Davis grant that we have at UConn is to offer faculty mini grants to do just exactly that. The grant will really be to ask them to compare and contrast and then to write something up that will be made publicly available to Connecticut. So perhaps we could expand that beyond what the capacity is of UConn to do. So I think and that's actually been done nationally. We didn't invent that idea, so I think it's a wonderful one. We could put that as a potential outcome.
Yeah, to your point that not only Merlot does it have a formal peer review process, but the Affordable Learning Solutions that came out of Cal State basically produces a faculty-reviewed website with any OER pieces. And then the Open Textbook Project that's out of the state of Minnesota has also another collection that is all faculty reviewed and vetted. One other potential topic, not necessarily in the short term, maybe the long term, is to look at what other states have done as far as a legislative or policy approach. I know off the top of my head that the federal government has been making huge strides towards open. That the federal government and the federal Department of Labor has issued a Creative Commons license structure for anything that's been federally funded, especially the TAC grants that some of the community colleges have that Creative Commons license requirement. That the federal Department of Education is also going that way. and that there's the Affordable College Textbook Act that's been reintroduced by Dick Durbin and Al Franken, and that there could be case studies or policies that we can mimic, like the Chancellor's Office out of the California Community College system, where anything that is funded by the system office has a Creative Commons stipulation to it.
Anything? You mean any course initiative or any new courses or any new grad?
I think it could be defined as we all, as it seems fit, but I think the particular piece is the broader notion that I think Cable Green has been quoted as saying if it's publicly funded, it should be publicly available.
Right. I think that's where a lot of the library community's been coming for a long time, and we haven't touched really the issue of textbooks. It's been, right. Mm-hmm.
I think one of the models out there that we might look at also is what's going on in the state of Georgia. I believe they have an incentive program for faculty, and it's I believe they grant them upwards of $10,000 to evaluate and take the time to see whether there are open educational resources that they could incorporate into their class. And I think that's, in some ways, that's the crux of the issue, is the time that it takes to step back from the teaching and actually look at what's out there. Because I'm sure that there's a lot out there that is not that great. But I think that some of these existing programs, like the University of Minnesota and Rice University, OpenStax, mm-hmm. May be something that faculty would use if they had the time to analyze it. And I don't think we expect that every course is going to become open educational resources. It's which ones might be appropriate and which faculty would be willing to investigate this.
I think there's one other issue that kind of syncs up with this, and I think Sally alluded to it earlier. The publishers have this very nice packaging.
Right.
And it's not just the textbook, it's the test pools, the questions, and the adaptive learning platforms. And it's very time-consuming to create your own test banks. There's a plethora of open resources out there that are very well done. University of Minnesota, OpenStax, Merlot, et cetera. But one thing that the publishers do is they provide some assessment materials in conjunction. And again, it takes a lot of time to develop those. And there's also all of those very sophisticated adaptive learning platforms. And so it's one thing to replace a textbook. It's another to rethink what the whole package is.
I was just going to mention that OpenStax, which is has a lot of foundation funding and is at Rice University, is looking very closely at those associated kinds of resources that get bundled with the textbook. So I believe that the community who's supporting OER are very aware of that. Whether that we'll have an easy, elegant solution the way commercial publishers do, I'm not sure, but I do think that there'll be some work in that area and probably something we should promote. Another idea to have people present, and I don't know if it's available for us to have people present to us via video conference, would be some of these national leaders that we've spoken about at OpenStax, at Spark, which is a scholarly publishing association that's been at the forefront nationally. So, would put that down as an idea for educating all ourselves. I learned a tremendous amount as chair of the committee with students. I think we all have a lot to learn. Daniel?
Just Dan's fine, thanks. It's important just to think about faculty and our needs in terms of textbooks. Obviously, as faculty, I'm well aware of those issues. Let's not forget about the students as well, and that is that publishers do produce things like quiz banks test quizzes for students to try out, flashcards, crossword puzzles, and so on and so forth. I'm not sure, honestly, how much they're used. I know they're popular among the publishers, and of course they cost money. But if students do use those and find them as helpful pedagogical tools, then we can't forget about their needs as well when we look at the OER.
The other thing we have to consider is student access. It sounds odd, but I sometimes have to direct my students to Clara in the library because they try to type their composition papers on their phone. They don't have computers at home. Some of them don't have internet access at home. And I think it would be a shame if we progress forward in this only to have some of the student money go from, say, textbook publishers to Verizon because they need larger data plans. So for some of these students, their phone is their only access at home to the internet, and it comes via Verizon and AT&T. And I think we need to be mindful of that as well, student access.
We've been talking so far about provision, about communication, about widening access. And I'd be interested also to think about whether there are examples or whether we have to invent an example of how we think about what we're trying to achieve in the large scale of things. I mean, our universities and our university systems are very complicated. They involve a very wide range of disciplines with each with very different needs and situations. And so has there been a program of this kind that has tried to set some kind of benchmark as to what the outcome should be for students? I mean, I'm not a quantitative person, but is there a target of sort of how much to reduce the expense to students that could be aimed at as some kind of measure of the success of a program like this? And have there been examples of that modeled already, or should we concern ourselves with thinking about how to do that as we develop our work?
I think it's an excellent question, and that's actually one that I've grappled with. What is our end goal? I know what our legislative one is, but as the goal of the state of Connecticut, is it solely to reduce the cost of textbooks for students? Is it more focused on affordability or zero cost sum? Are we going to tie in anything about student outcomes or student improvements in here? And to date, we've only talked about open textbooks, but the open community is a much broader conversation. So, you know, we can define that as we go forward, but to not only mention what Christopher said, but to echo back to Pat, I think that the appropriate phrase is when appropriate, so that we're not trying to do a universal replacement of all commercial textbooks or any associated or supplemental instruction tools, that if, when appropriate, we can replace a costly textbook or a costly course material fee with something that's low cost, no cost to the student's benefit, we should consider that.
I also say that in terms of James' comment that there are many of the open textbooks are available in a very inexpensive print form. So, for example, the chemistry textbook that we're looking at would be available in paperback, all 500 pages of it, for probably around $50. So that also reduces the cost, and your comment about the data plan is certainly well noted.
This is something I've heard from the students, although they could be lying to me.
I'm always worried about my data plan.
Just to throw it out there, if we start with a broader umbrella topic, a statement of when appropriate, can we start working towards select low-cost, no-cost replacement items that meet the academic needs or outcomes of the student and faculty? Just to throw that as a conversation starter.
Well, I think we have a short amount of time here to accomplish something, and that seems to be a place that many of us have started by analyzing what are the high enrollment, highest cost books, and starting to target those, talking to faculty, showing them what's available, and you know, you'll have impact right away. That's where we came up with the $400,000 savings if we were to adopt the chemistry textbook.
I also think faculty talking to other faculty is a really effective way to spread the word, because I think there are faculty that are already doing this to some extent and would be willing to share their experience with others. That's what I'm trying to get going as just a very small beginning at Eastern. And I think that although the focus of our committee is on what's defined as open educational resources, which are open access materials that are free in the public domain, there are other initiatives out there, such as the one at UMass Amherst, where they're trying to promote a hybrid model where the faculty use not only what's truly in the Creative Commons licensed materials, open access, but also leverage what their libraries are already paying for. In a lot of cases, some combination of those resources could serve the students, and the money that's already being spent, you know, would be leveraged. So I think that's another way that some faculty are trying to reduce costs to students and still provide a quality product.
I think also, you know, when I talk with our faculty, and we've had a number of meetings and a number of discussions, part of the issue is that they just feel overwhelmed with all the choices. There's so much stuff out there, and you know, many of them have said, "I would just like somebody to tell us what, you know, how we can take a quality look at what seems to be being used by other faculty in other states that have worked well." Because you look at, I mean, you know how I felt when I called you about this. I had, you know, 40 resources, all of these stacks and programs and places and people. And you know, I spent maybe 2 8-hour periods on it, and I was actually more confused afterwards. So, and I think faculty that have heavy teaching loads. So somehow, if we could come up by content area, by psychology or history, with what might be the top 4 suggestions for faculty teaching in, and I realize even that is difficult because you have various disciplines in here, history, various areas in history or psychology, but I think breaking it down a little bit, because right now it just seems like, because there's been so much interest, there seems to be this vast array of links and places, but I don't really think people have a sense of where to start. So maybe we even produce a few case studies of people that are using things and how they determine what to use, and a few faculty members in Connecticut that are successful at doing this might reduce some of the anxiety and give people a concrete plan for how, and it may be a combination, it might be a hybrid approach. I don't know what Dan thinks, but to me this might be I think we got to make it a little bit easier.
I was going to say, not about that, but in response to something else you said about disciplines, that disciplines are very, very important. The science changes in some areas much faster than it does in others. So, for example, a history book you don't have to change that much from 2015, 2017, because history hasn't changed quite as much as things like, I mean, you might disagree, but as psychology has. I mean, literally, I get journals like this on my desk several times a week with all this new research. And on the one hand, we don't want to make students buy books all the time, new editions all the time. It's true. We don't want to do that. It's unnecessary and expensive. But yet, we also want to make sure our students are exposed to the newest science and not books that are 5, 10 years out of date, because then they're looking at the news and saying, oh, this is going on in the news, but where's the research behind this? Well, it isn't there yet. It's not in the books that we're using. So we do move along very, very quickly in psychology. You have to balance those two things out. You know, contemporary new stuff with not requiring students to spend huge amounts of money every single year for new editions. So if there's some hybrid version, we could actually have, maybe still have some hardcovers out there or softcovers out there that are paper, though, and then update in some other way, you know, electronic updates or cheaper updates. Students could still buy last year's textbook from Amazon and then get an update for that textbook for this year would be fantastic. Maybe a hybrid, not sure you would think of that kind of hybrid yourself, but something like that might be a feasible alternative for some disciplines.
Actually, history does change quite a lot, but that's why we're still in business. But I mean, the point is that, as you are saying, Dan, I mean, many disciplines have different disciplines have very different models. So, in fact, history is an example of a field where it is already relatively easy to construct what here is being referred to as a hybrid model. And in fact, I and many of my colleagues do that. You know, last semester I taught a course where I used entirely no-cost materials for students. This semester, for different reasons, I've assigned books, but I have ensured that the maximum cost to any student would be under $100, and yet they get all the materials. So I think one of the issues that we do need to think about is where our efforts are going to be most likely to be cost-effective for students. And the whole point, which was already happening at UConn, I guess, where we're looking at the high-volume, high-cost areas and in some ways focusing on that, while at the same time disseminating information elsewhere, because I guess every time I run a course where the students don't have to pay anything for their materials, that kind of helps them eke out their situation with the other courses they have to do. So we all contribute. But the other really serious question is one that Dan has raised, which is we could set up a system, we could provide advice, we could get something going out of this task force, but how are we going to have a model for continuing it? Because everything that is handled in our system as we create it will have to be recreated because of the need for update, for advances in the fields and so forth, pretty much continuously. And to play devil's advocate for a minute, I mean, there are people, and I imagine not far from where we sit, who will say the only way you can guarantee that kind of improvement is by leaving it to the market and let people pay for it. And that ensures that things get produced, that updates, that money is put into research, and so forth. And so I think we have a very important kind of public role in trying to think of another model that can simulate what a private market system can achieve at an adequate enough level for our students who can't afford to take part in that market because they just don't have the resources.
I want to tag team up with something you said earlier, and it really had to do with outcomes and goals and measures. And perhaps one of the early steps is to think about what are our short-term goals that we have versus our long-term goals, and how will we benchmark each of those. So it's not realistic to say we're going to have this huge open-source repository for all materials, but short-term, if you target to, which you've already done, high volume, high cost, maybe as an initial step, or, again, some of it might just be a faculty group that might have some initial buy-in, which might derail what you have, but that's okay, because we need some initial buy-in to set, I don't know, some benchmarking, and then talk about phase one, phase two, and how do you create processes for continuous improvement so that this doesn't become the dead repository, which would become realistic if you don't have a long-term process in place.
I think that might be why you have a lot of librarians in here. We've been in the business of selecting and deselecting and trying to put the right materials in the hands of the faculty, students, based on their guidance. But I certainly agree that in the short amount of time we have here, we should focus on a few short-term goals and then put forth some more future-oriented ideas. Kevin, do you have anything more?
No, I completely agree. And, you know, going back to your point about getting a baseline,
yeah,
just seeing where the state is, longer term or even more near term, we can evaluate solutions like the affordable learning solutions out of Cal State, which is what seems to be discussed in some form or fashion of having this vetted peer review repository that is hand-selected for Connecticut goals. And that is something that Cal State is licensing for states to adopt. So Georgia's initiative is based on the Cal State infrastructure. So we can have somebody like Jerry Hanley remotely present to the group and get an understanding of what the product is meant to do, but still work towards gathering data.
And on April 19th, David Wiley will be at UConn. He's a national leader in this area, has put forth a model through Lumen Learning. So I think we have other opportunities, and certainly all the members of this group and in the state will be invited. Yeah.
Does either Kevin, Martha, or anybody else in this room sort of have a fairly comprehensive list that at least all of us have access to of the many repositories that are currently in existence? I mean, I know we all probably have some, but it would be nice if we were all referencing a comprehensive list.
And maybe that's what we should do, is look among ourselves to see, you know, we have started a guide, you know, we have it broken down by discipline and have bought samples, you know, examples that we bring out to the faculty of the print versions of the electronic. So, you know, maybe we could take a look at, through email, analyzing what each of our institutions has done already, or some of the models. Kevin obviously has some good intel into what's going on nationally with some models. Yes. Right. It's really a website guide that, you know, by discipline that, you know, we use. We also have a cadre of students who go out and they'll take, you know, so they'll go to their faculty members, they'll pick a half dozen faculty members and go with examples of the open resources in those disciplines. Although I think the best approach will be faculty talking to faculty rather than students and the library folks. So.
I just would share that we brought Martha in to do a workshop for our department heads. And so I think we had 70 department heads in attendance, and that probably was a kickoff to, you know, a lot of the follow-up. So not every department, you know, had an interest in doing something, but we knew we couldn't start with every department, and we really looked to see how many department heads might have an interest in pursuing this, and then kind of the effort started to multiply across and among. So maybe the website that we've developed at UConn, just because it's already there, could be a repository for this group, and we could let, I mean, we also could set up another one, I guess, you know, a legislative website, but since ours is already up there and started, maybe we could start to add other resources to that. But that is what I meant when I said when people look at too much, it is sometimes overwhelming. So it's a matter of how, you know, sorting it, I think, by discipline, or that might be helpful to faculty members out there across the state.
I think that there are actually quite a few of these guides, and I'm sure the UConn one is a really good one. I know that Gateway has one, and we put together one that I am not making any particular claims for, but just so that, you know, I can point my faculty into a direction. So, and the software that most of us use to create these guides allows us to clone them easily with permission. So whether it's, you know, directly the one that you've got at UConn, which I'm perfectly fine with, or if we adapt it in some way and put, you know, state task force guide, the software allows us to do that with permission, so we could look at what's the best way to go.
And I'll be more than happy to reach out and grab, you know, either Tacoma Community Colleges, University of Maryland, UMass, Amherst, what have you, and add those to the collection. The thought that I'm hearing or having in my head at the moment is that, yes, faculty are absolutely the critical component to all of this, but there are supporting mechanisms for faculty. So part of it is the library, part of it is administration, part of it is IT or faculty support on campus. And we have three of those groups represented here. And long term, there may be the need to have the conversation or even go subcommittee route to have librarians work together and cull items and create a track that supports this initiative, have faculty among this around this table and then additional folks come in and basically talk about steps, policies, best practices, and then administrators from what policies on your campus or even at the state level can help support these initiatives and make it easier. So just maybe a long-term conversation about breaking down the conversations.
And I think that that's really the focus of it, is what can we agree on and not get bogged down in the things that we may find contentious, because this is such a big project, and I think there probably is enough common ground to accomplish a goal of moving forward, because it's you know, there are a lot of issues, and Dan has raised them, and they're legitimate issues, and so if we could find some things that we agree would move this forward, I think that would really be an accomplishment.
I'm also hearing that, you know, we're really talking about affordability as opposed to strictly open and freely available, and if we could speak some more about that, because we might be limiting ourselves too much by saying we're going to focus only on what's open, but what is how do we move the market towards affordability, and what do we look at that helps us in that regard? I think I'm hearing that all around the room.
And to your point earlier, Martha, not only do you have David Wiley coming out, he represents Lumen Learning, and we'll be talking about supplemental instruction or tools that support instruction. Lumen has those connected solutions, like MyOpenMath that's connected to the OpenCourseWare. So they are working like OpenStax to connect to homework sites and other supportive tools.
We've been hearing, you know, loud and clear that those bundles are what's really important to try to either unbundle or break that market, because truly a student can't resell their textbook. I mean, if they don't have the code, the book is not sellable.
Are there models of beyond the ones that you've already mentioned of publishers who have come into the market in order to provide less unaffordable material? I mean, if we're talking about the high price of things, then free market economics tells us that someone should come in and undercut them. Now, this doesn't happen, we know. This is like pharmaceuticals or whatever, and there are somewhat similar patterns here. But have there been examples? And have there been examples of states? I mean, we know at the high school textbook level that Texas, for example, is an extraordinarily influential mover simply because it's so big. Does it have any clout at the college level in the same way? And what have people done in Texas to cut costs?
There is a second generation of publishers out there. So there are companies like Sumo, like XYZ Textbooks, that are a fraction of what the big three are.
Yeah.
And they're trying to do new models where they're maybe producing more interactive. They may be going to a digital format with print as a secondary option, or trying to go to more mobile device or mobile-friendly devices. But they still have the traditional hard-bound, you know, printed book as an option. And they're, generally speaking, they've been about a third of the price of what your traditional commercial vendor's been.
I think that can be one of the really good byproducts of initiatives like this, is that I think it can influence the marketplace. Because as these open access efforts gain traction, I think some of the high-priced textbook publishers are going to realize that their unfair profit margins are not going to be sustained as people start to look for alternatives. So, you know, clearly they do provide value, but whether they need that much profit to provide the value is the real question.
There's also the profit of the bookstore itself. Are we under any legal requirements with bookstores in our system? Because a couple years ago I tried to put together a packet, a course pack, which I thought would save money for students, and in fact it wound up costing just about the same because the markup in the bookstore was so high. It was an issue.
So I can talk specifically about the Board of Regents. I was just invited to a committee meeting last week with the bookstore. So the community college, specifically the community college bookstore RFP, is up for renewal. And the committee is looking at ways to rewrite the language that would be more open-friendly or more student affordability-focused available. And there are providers like OpenStax that do work with bookstore providers to actually have the open source text printed, bound, and on the shelf for students, and they can use their financial aid monies as they would for any commercial piece. So there are vendors or OER providers that work with current bookstores, but the Board of Regents is looking at the language of their bookstore RFPs to allow for a more open initiative.
So University of Connecticut's opened up the bookstore as an RFP, and we were quite careful to weave that into our language also. So, yeah. Sure, the RFP's up there for anyone to see. I think to James's point also about course packs, I know that I'll go back to an initiative at UMass where now I think that most of the course pack content sort of filters through the library to be sure that there isn't something that's already available and you're not paying for it twice. Or sometimes there might be alternatives, but I think that's the awareness piece of what's available out there and what do these things cost. What I've heard is that many faculty really don't know the cost of the textbook or the course pack and don't know what the markup is in their particular bookstore, so are often surprised. So maybe not many, but enough so that there's enough concern about when a faculty member chooses a book at the recommendation of a commercial publisher.
Is there a way of providing them with that information relatively easily? I mean, and making it good practice that faculty should consider that.
Several of the larger bookstores operators have systems whereby if a faculty member enters their discipline, they're given the textbook that they're currently using, and they're given multiple other suggestions of less expensive textbooks, including the professors at other institutions that have, not the names of the professors, but the institutions that have adopted this as their primary text. And then there's some systems. We looked at a system called Academos. It's a Connecticut-based company, for example, that also tells them about open source material that could substitute. And some of the systems we looked at also lets a faculty member upload the potential course pack they want to use, and it gives them the actual price so they can compare that. But these are, they vary by who you look at, whether it's Academos or Barnes & Noble or Amazon. I mean, they're all different. So almost all of the new systems, though, have some built-in ability to do this. And probably the most common is the ability to compare a standard textbook with a open source and then your own course pack that you might put together. And we've seen, you know, at least three or four in these meetings we've been having to look at what we want for our students and in the most reasonable cost. We've seen three or four different examples of ways this can be done. We currently don't have that at UConn in our current iteration of what we offer students. There's now some comparison that our co-op has put in, but it's limited.
if you don't mind, I'd just like to take 1 second. So we do have only, we have one student present. Well, hopefully we'll have more, but I'd love to hear Dan's thoughts on what you've been hearing for the last hour.
So in terms of targeting high-cost, high-volume classes and textbooks, I think that would be probably the best efforts for this committee. I think it targets the issue that Dan brought up about changing fields changing rapidly. Generally, I've found in my introduction courses that these are classes that have materials that generally don't change. The foundations of psychology don't change. Generally, maybe the higher course level content does change with new research and things like that. So that's my biggest takeaway from the last hour of conversation, that the UConn co-op also provided us with information regarding which textbook costs the most and how many students are offered that textbook. And often it's the intro level classes that are costing $250, $300 and have 400 people in the classroom. So if we want to target the most students, I believe that we should be targeting classrooms that have the most students with the highest cost textbooks. And often a lot of the textbooks already available under an open license are those four introductory level classes. So continuing to find those resources and making those available to students at our schools, I think, would be the best for this committee to focus on.
Students, I just want to add that it might be good to conduct student survey to find out how, added to the faculty survey we're planning to do, to find out how students are using textbooks, if some of them are buying them and they are not buying them, their major concerns. We need to know that, and that will help us to figure out how to go about having a student survey, maybe through the student government.
So at the University of Connecticut, our UConn chapter of the Connecticut Public Interest Group 2 years ago conducted a survey. I think we would be more than willing to do another one. But just I can bring that to our next meeting, hopefully get those results, and just see what we found 2 years ago and see if those same details come out if we do another survey. I was a participant in that survey. I was the one that helped conduct the survey, and the vast majority of students had skipped out on buying a textbook at least once in their career, had dropped a class because the textbook was too expensive and they didn't know prior to registration what the textbook was going to cost. The average student spent $1,200 a year on textbooks in our survey. Those are just the things that I can remember off the top of my head, but I can bring some of that data to the next meeting.
Maybe you could even share it.
Yeah, absolutely.
We did, as part of the student survey, also try to identify from our co-op the numbers of students that were not buying books for classes, but that's so difficult now because, you know, 80 to 90% of our students, we've learned, are actually buying books, you know, outside of the traditional bookstore experience right now. And of course, those are the ones that are buying books, not course packs. So we looked at course packs, and we found from what we could tell that people had to buy from our time, even with course packs, you know, there was a fairly large variety of percentages of students who bought, indicating most likely that people are sharing. And I think we're seeing more of that as a way to combat affordability. But I think what we found out to some extent, 80% of our students are trying to buy their textbooks offline on Amazon. There's like seven sites now, Amazon being the most successful, but there's half-price books, there's student-to-student sharing services. So this has become a cottage industry of students trying to help other students, primarily if they can't sell their books back or if they sell their books back for a very small amount. So there's a lot of student activism out there, which I think is really good. The challenge is, of course, that how do we make what some students are learning about how to discount their prices a little bit more available to other students?
And this may be longer term, but as this conversation continues throughout UConn, many faculty have approached me that to say that, you know, I publish a textbook. My royalties aren't that great. They're not making a living off royalties. So how could I make that available with a Creative Commons license? So that may be longer term for us, but would be to really think about how to incentivize or teach faculty, encourage more faculty here to share their content, whether it's, you know, from the results of federally funded research or just because it's their own research. Many faculty, as you, Chris, said, you have had courses where there's no cost at all because you've cobbled together resources. I know that lots of faculty are willing to share what they've put together for their low cost. Their MIT has their open courseware, which has an awful lot of good. It's really the syllabus, it's really the course, but there's still a lot of open resources to be found in those kinds of initiatives. So which faculty are willing to share what they've already written, I think might be another thing to look at.
I just want to say that I think we have to make sure that faculty know what's out there. Sometimes faculty don't know what they don't know. And like you said, to bring them to it, they might look at you and go, they don't even know what an OER is. And to know how, and again, if you bring them to these sites, it's so overwhelming. And that we need to have a way to show them how to evaluate an ORE and maybe have other faculty show those kind of ideas.
I think that's an excellent point because, as I mentioned in the introduction, you know, for the past 3 years, we've been doing awareness building throughout the state. And even in continuing into 2016, we're still doing awareness building. And I think it was the Babson study that came out last year or the year before that's on a national level. It's still greater than 65% of all faculty at a nationwide level still don't know what OER is, never mind how to research for it. So there's still this whole awareness issue that we still have to tackle.
Takes us back to the survey. In a way, a survey is a method of raising awareness as well as seeing where the community is with awareness. So as we think about how to construct it to also serve that purpose.
But we might also develop a relatively simple PowerPoint that could be distributed to department heads and deans, I mean, across the state. You know, kind of what are some of the resources? What are some things that innovative Connecticut colleges are using? You know, a 20 slide PowerPoint that could be sent to every department head, dean or department head in the state of Connecticut that could be presented at the faculty meeting could be a way in Connecticut to move that awareness from, you know, 20-30% to 90%. As long as the department head, and maybe even embedded in that is a short video that we might be able, maybe we could do that as part of our grant at UConn and have some people on this group actually appear in the brief video that could be sent to all faculty. You know, it'd be great to go faculty member to faculty member, but I know having been a department head, having Chris here, my guess is that a lot of department heads would be happy to have that content prepared for them, and then with a place for questions. That might be a way that we could work collaboratively. Probably you, Martha, may have some of this done because you did a PowerPoint for the deans. You may have some of it. And just a thought, but that would be, I think, a really good outcome of this committee.
Yeah, and to go along with that or follow up on that, even to maybe create modules for faculty to, you know, how to find an ORE that's according to your discipline, how do we evaluate one? And then kind of play around in how to edit or adapt and all those things that, you know, those buzzwords that come along with those.
If I could just add that one of the ways that faculty have of getting around the textbook cost issue is to cobble together courses, right, either their own course packets or what have you. But there's an issue underlying some of that, and that is fair use. And if I want to ask a student, in fact, my classes, I have just one class where I have a textbook. The other ones I don't use textbooks at all in. And instead, I put together chapters, copies of chapters or articles or whatever, which are sort of walking a very fine line between can I allow 25 students in my class to download a free PDF that I got through my library and put online? Is that really fair use? And so one of the ways I do get around textbook use is to put primary source articles online. But by doing so, I know that it's not, there's been no legal case yet saying I can't do that, but I know that's an issue that's out there, and there has been some legal action about it. So it's not just textbooks we're talking about here. Textbooks are wonderful for some courses, but for many courses, they just aren't appropriate in my mind. We shouldn't be using them at all, no matter how good they are, no matter how recent they are. And so if we're not using textbooks, how can we find other resources that are both up-to-date, peer-reviewed, and cost-effective, again, that aren't textbooks? Let's not forget that many classes don't use textbooks and shouldn't use textbooks.
Yep. And so the PowerPoint that Sally has proposed would presumably have to include some very basic legal guidance that will address that point. I mean, it strikes me that the most powerful place for any of this to take place in the end is going to be in faculty meetings within particular departments, where if we as colleagues are stimulated to think about this question because we are told or we realize that it is a really important question for our mm-hmm. students, mm-hmm. and the state and our institutions are concerned about it, then if we can talk among ourselves about how we do this in our particular field, in our particular institution, knowing our needs and demands, that is the most effective way of communicating. And then being able to say, look, you can't do that. You know, you can't download 7 chapters of the book you'd really like to assign. But there are things you can do within the law that will enable you to do these things. The guidance of that kind, I think, would be lead to very fruitful and effective, and faculty aware of this issue will then complete the process.
So there seems to be two strains. So there's a data collection piece that we have to do, but there's also a collection or report back. And one of those pieces sounds like what laws or policies are already in place. So I'm blanking on the name of the law, the federal law that basically says that schools have to disclose not only the book price prior, but they also have to...
The IS Higher Education Opportunity
right,
Act.
So we could
the ISBN numbers as well.
Yes. Right. So we probably could put something in here. I know fair use is a sort of an ambiguous piece, but we can at least maybe include an interpretation of some sorts. One that we refer to quite often is University of Maryland, University Colleges, that talks about brevity and frequency. You know, as long as it's not the entire sum of work and you're using it in a non-frequent manner, you're in good standing. But if you start using it every semester, every class over a period of time, it no longer falls in that fair use piece. So I'm not an attorney, so I'm just reiterating what was read. So we'd have to find some type of interpretation that the state agrees upon.
I think you're right. There's a lot of education to do about fair use. More faculty are afraid to put things up than, from my experience, because they're afraid of the copyright police, when we have a lot of leverage as public educational institutions around the TEACH Act. I think some basic education. So far I'm hearing that we have a need to educate ourselves, and we can do that in a variety of ways. We'll some survey to find out where our own faculties are, that will send around our websites of resources, and so we'll share some survey tool, come up with a tool, we'll send our websites around, we'll identify presenters who could help educate ourselves, We'll look at some of the data on high cost, high volume books and bring those back to the group. Those could be some of our shorter term goals, and then come up with a plan for educating others. And there's been a lot of ideas already shared here about what we might do to educate our faculty. Once we maybe decide what kind of awareness education the faculty could use, then develop or recommend the development of a set of tools to pull some that already exist or come up with some tools that we'd like to see. I've also heard that we sort of expanded our notion of open text to be affordability, that we're looking at developing or looking at affordability as a concept around hybrid, open, or even low-cost publishers to do some research into that. So I'm trying to come up with some deliverables besides a report, but those seem to me to be our activities. The deliverables would be the report, the information that we've developed about our population here in Connecticut, and then perhaps some PowerPoint tools and those kinds of things. So have I captured what it is that our conversation is? Are we missing it? And I'm not trying to wrap things up. I need to get myself, if Kevin and I are going to chat and co-chair, a sense of where we're going to go with this group.
I think you did a tremendous summary, but I want to echo Martha's thoughts. Is there anything that we missed in the summary?
I mean, not just because I'm worried about Connecticut funding, but also because I'm wondering if we are going to do this and try to, you know, become one of the states that's leading in this effort, might we consider any funding opportunities, foundation? I mean, we got a small, we may want to talk about the foundation grant that we got, but as a group, I think collectively we might be able to work well together to find some funding. It'd be wonderful, for example, here's just a few ideas. So a summer conference for faculty on the use of open source textbooks. It may not be that it's that expensive to run that, but it would be nice to offer people, you know, lunch and some free resources. I mean, if we could think of a couple of funding sources that might help us become a little bit more organized in our approach and be able to do a few more things. For example, putting a traveling workshop together in the summer that could go across the state to the four major Board of Regents, four-year schools, some of the community colleges, UConn. If we got 15 or 20 faculty to attend that across the state, we would be, you know, escalating our number of faculty that might have an interest in using or developing. So we might want to think about whether there would be any private foundation, given, again, the state's issues here, financial issues this year. Maybe we could think about what foundation we might approach to be able to do that. Or maybe there's some book lovers in the state that would be interested in helping us figure out how to do this. I don't know. I'm just thinking that might be a way to do this.
Kevin had on the way in mentioned an opportunity that he's looking at exploring. Was looking for some ideas, and I think that maybe the gravitas of this group could help us.
Yeah. So one of the roles that the consortium plays is we try to find grant opportunities for specific to this initiative and broader. The pure fact of it is Connecticut and New England in and of itself is a decade behind what the OER initiative is. So many of the funding sources have already tapped out on institution-based funding or system-based funding. They're looking for something that's maybe a little bit more attractive. Mm-hmm. So the Northeast OER Consortium, which is a multi-state loose affiliation, is an attractive vehicle towards funders. And we were approached recently by the Online Learning Consortium, which used to be the Sloan C Consortium. And they were just awarded $2.5 million from the Gates Foundation this past October, and they're looking for ways to have innovative solutions or proposals put to spend down that money. And they're looking for Connecticut, Massachusetts, and whoever else wants to partner to put together a proposal that would utilize this money for OER initiatives. So we're finding a little bit more information on that this Thursday afternoon. But to Sally's point, the Northeast OER Consortium has tried to partner with the surrounding players to put these OER type events. So UMass at Shrewsbury has been kind enough to host a regional event each of the last 3 years, and there may be opportunities to partner with the UMass system or the Mass Colleges Online or SUNY or other entities that have been participating in these conversations to do something that distributes the cost evenly across multiple players.
I've been quiet for some time, but I will just say that I appreciate Sally's recognition that there's not a lot of extra money here at the state capitol. And also, I just want to say, I think that this conversation has been generative in the true sense of the word. It's been a little sort of free-ranging and roving, and that's good. I think that's what an organizational meeting should be about. How do we sort of figure out what we can accomplish and to meet our mission? So I appreciate all of your individual efforts at meetings like this and back at your institutions to sort of address this concern. I had sort of resolved myself to going to another meeting at 11:30. It's concerning the budget of the Board of Regents. And so I know that at least a third of you will be happy that I'm going off to that meeting. But I did just want to say again, I think that Martha and Kevin are on the right track in terms of proposing, sort of outlining the discussion today. I appreciate all of your efforts and sort of being willing to involve yourself in this. There are two other students that have been appointed to this committee that were not able to attend today. They are Richard Burke from Fairfield University and Saman Azimi from UConn. They will both participate in future meetings, but I would encourage you, as you're thinking about meeting times and stuff like that, to as well just think about how we might ensure that the inclusion of those student voices, because it can be somewhat challenging, I think, to get them given their schedules as well.
So will we have the assistance of Kristen in organizing our meetings? And I don't know if we should talk about sort of the meeting frequency and how we get together.
Kristen left the room, and so it's a good time for us to offer him up.
That's what I was.
But I did just want to also introduce I have two staffers. I have an intern and my legislative aide are sitting at the small desk over here. Marianne McCabe Daly is on the left, and Alicia DeVito is on the right. The legislation outlines that the committee staff of the Higher Education Committee is responsible for doing administrative support for this group. Those functions are actually being carried out by my legislative aide and my intern, and so they've been over there, I think, diligently taking notes and will do their best to create minutes. And then moving forward, we can obviously serve as a resource for folks if you're looking for meeting space here. There is nothing, I think, that requires you to have meetings here at the legislative office building, although there's some advantages to doing that because folks like them are available to offer support. I'll have a further conversation with both Kevin and Martha about administrative support for the group.
Great. Thank you very much. So should we think about the frequency of meetings or do that offline as part of administrative support or meeting place? I don't know how difficult it was for folks to get here, if there's any value in rotating where we meet. Just ideas.
Yeah, central at least.
So we have a central meeting place here, and so we'll probably be looking for rooms here. We have an awful lot of work to do by the end of, I think our report is due in, you're giving us until October? Oh, the bill says that. Yeah, okay. We started a little bit late. I was thinking we didn't have that much time, but October is going to come fast. So we can do an awful lot offline, but monthly meetings?
Fine.
Maybe some subcommittees, I heard, as we move forward. Maybe a faculty subcommittee, a subcommittee of the folks in the libraries who are putting together websites and so on. But we could talk a little bit more about that. But I do think that coming up with some clear guidance from faculty and ideas from faculty would be really important to do.
Are we going to set up a time for our next meeting and that's a date?
If you're going to meet in this building, then you can give us some sort of idea about sense about what your target might be, and then Marianne and other folks can sort of work to make sure that there's a room available at the specific time that you're looking at. We're in competition with other sort of lots of other groups, and of course the work of the legislature. We don't adjourn in our short session until May 4th. After that, it, you know, becomes a guarantee that you can find a meeting room here. But between now and then, other groups have priority, and so give us a target, and we'll do the best we can to meet your needs.
Was this time, sort of Monday morning, or was that previous date that we had Friday? It was a Friday, so Mondays or Fridays, or does anyone have any sense of a better day of the week? Oh, I see. Oh, okay, right. Well, I wrote you an excuse now. No. Maybe we need to do something like a doodle poll rather than come to consensus here. So we'll work with the legislative aides, come up with some, do some sort of doodle poll and come up with some dates within about a month. Will you be attending any more of our meetings?
I will attend all that I'm available.
So we'll include you on the doodle poll. Thank you very much.
If I may ask you to hand me the form with the information so I have the best means of contacting you all, I appreciate it. Thank you.